This is the Gould Standard, Episode 63, Micah Hendler and the Jerusalem Youth Chorus, Healing Through Harmony.
Hello, friends. This is the Gould Standard. I'm Brian Levine. This is a podcast brought to you by the Glenn Gould Foundation. Every week, we bring you conversations with some of the most amazing people from all across the world of the arts. And today, we have a very special episode. If I can take a moment to say, if you're like me, it can be a pretty down time. There's a lot of bad news. I don't like to pick up my newsreader anymore because there's just so much depressing stuff. And you wonder what's happening in the world and are things ever going to get better? But the more I think about it, the more I think that the big stuff out there is very hard for us to control. There are small victories to be won, and some of those victories are things that we can control ourselves. Every time we strike a blow for understanding, for communication, for finding a way to just connect with other people, when we think that we're separated by a great divide, I think we have a small victory. And today, our guest is someone whose life and work really exemplifies that principle. We're joined by Micah Hendler. Micah is the founder and artistic director of the Jerusalem Youth Chorus, and based, as the name suggests, in Jerusalem. It is a really incredible choir, and what sets them apart is that 50% of their members are Israeli, and the other half are Palestinians, and through music they find a way of not making the problems go away. They don't gloss over the heartache and the trauma and the terrible things that they face in their lives, but they do find a way to coexistence and greater understanding. They find harmony through harmony. So, Micah, I really am delighted that you're joining us. I think that your story is one that we all need to hear right now. It's definitely a morale boost for those of us who are sometimes feeling a little discouraged. Why don't you tell us, to start with, a little bit about your background? Because you aren't from Jerusalem originally. And, you know, how did you find your way onto this path?
Sure. Brian, thank you so much. Thanks for having me and for all the opportunities, hopefully, that we'll have to create some change together through music. I'm Micah Hendler. I am from Washington, D.C., and grew up in the U.S., where I really found a lot of power, both in musical communities, really just in groups of people who are singing. Actually, as an awkward kid growing up who was bullied a lot, I was really only accepted in groups of people who were singing. And so, needless to say, those became very important spaces for me. And the other stream, of course, is Israeli-Palestinian conflict resolution, specifically through dialogue work. And those two threads, as I was growing up, I experienced different layers and depths of the power of both music as a community-building technology and dialogue, facilitated dialogue as a conflict transformation technology. And essentially, as I was then in my teenage years, I saw that I actually had the power to create spaces for each of those and experience them in depth and experience firsthand not just what it was like to be in somebody else's singing community, but actually to create one and to see that I could show other people not only that they could sing and they could belong, but that I could create this whole new community and circle of friends just by calling a rehearsal. And for 15-year-old me, that was a revelation. And similarly, on the dialogue side, I grew up, you know, in a pretty standard American Jewish community with very one-sided, you know, views and perspectives when it came to Israel-Palestine. And it wasn't until I actually was in a dialogue process and met Palestinians and heard their stories from them that I saw outside the education that I had received. And that process was very, very important to me. And I stayed involved with that work. And then I saw that music could play these same kinds of community building, identity forming roles, even in this context where people are supposed to hate each other and have nothing in common. And that the music and the dialogue could strengthen one another to create a really transformative process. So I was sort of realizing that over time. I had many other experiences also on the ground in Jerusalem and elsewhere in the Middle East, where I was experiencing some of the power and also limitations of both music and dialogue in tackling this extremely challenging set of problems, but ultimately kept gaining more tools and more inspiration and more relationships that could help ground the work that I ultimately have come to do with the Jerusalem Youth Chorus.
Right. So let's take it back to kind of the very beginning, when you were feeling kind of alone, bullied, alienated as a kid. How did you first encounter that sense of community that came through singing and music making? Were there some formative influences? Was it like a high school music teacher? Was there a community choir that you joined or volunteered in? Was it through your synagogue? What was the entry point?
So it's really interesting. I mean, to some extent, all of the above. But the entry point really was singing in harmony with my mom in Jewish settings. And singing in, she had a singing group of moms of my like preschool friends that they formed. They were very, very good. They all sang in like improvised sort of six-part harmony with each of them also played multiple instruments. And they rehearsed in my house. And so like that was sort of my initial musical, context, right? And of course the context of just kind of singing in harmony, improvised harmony, was, I've been, harmonizing since I was five. And so that for me was important because A, of course, that then is holding some tension with the other things that I learned in the Jewish community that have served me less well, as I was mentioning on the dialogue side, and the sort of limitations of some of the perspectives that I learned. But also, it informed the way that I approach musical community building, because once I didn't sing in a choir. I didn't know what a choir was until I was like 11. And my mom thought that I should audition for the Children's Chorus of Washington. And I didn't even want to do it because I just didn't even know what it was. She was like, no, you'll like it. So I went to the audition. I passed the audition because I knew how to sing, but I was able to do some sight reading because I had taken some piano lessons. But I'd never sung from sheet music before. And so I go to my first rehearsal, and I remember I was seated in the alto twos, right? I was, I was 11, and we start singing the piece, and I just start harmonizing, and they're like, that's wrong. I was like, what do you mean that's wrong? Like, I know what I'm doing. Like, I know that that was in the chord. Like, I know that that sounded good. They're like, no, that's not your part. I was like, what do you mean my part? Right. So there were just all these ways in which I think folks who come from a very sort of traditional Western classical perspective about everything don't even know in many cases that the assumptions that they're making about what music is are limiting and limited.
Right. And of course, it's one of the challenges that certain aspects of training in Western classical music, but also other kinds of music where things have, specific charts, specific parts, is that there is a kind of an almost martial regimentation about it. Whereas you grew up, and by the time you arrived, your brain was pre-wired to hear and make harmony.
Exactly. And that journey also continued as I then in high school sang in everywhere I could, and in college as well. And in college, I was studying music and international studies at Yale. And the music department was so relentlessly hierarchical about Western classical music being like the only form of music basically that was worth studying. And to me, I was offended by that, not only on an ideological level, but even just on a personal level.
Yeah.
Right. I was like, what do you mean the music that I grew up singing isn't worth studying?
Right. Exactly. And I mean, that actually surprises me because let's face it, you know, you're not that old a guy, Micah. You know, this is a world in which, you know, jazz is a high art form and has been recognized for, you know, this is a world in which we've had Alan Lomax, you know, collect the folk music that is the backbone of many aspects of Western classical music. And, you know, the understanding about improvisation, the understanding about, you know, music handed down from generation to generation, and, you know, the incredible diversity of global styles that grow out of the people. So that actually surprises me a lot that there you find yourself in an environment where there was seemingly no awareness of that. I mean, maybe
there was some in pockets, right? Like I took every sort of non-Western musical, you know, course I could find, but there were like five of them and half of them were graduate courses, right? It was my advisor was the one full-time ethnomusicology professor on the entire campus.
Wow, that's really something. So how did you manage to navigate through? Did you just decide to leave, or did you sort of tough it out and I toughed it out
and took a lot of graduate courses. Because, you know, and some of those were amazing, right? There was a course I took called Music and Empire, right? That was looking at what are the ways in which music has been used both as a tool of imperialism and colonization, and what are the ways that imperial movements have affected musical cultures. And, you know, just like stuff like that, you know, were fascinating. But ultimately, I stuck with it because I felt I needed it as a credential to be able to do other things, even if I would learn more relevant things by not, you know, completing this particular major.
Right.
So, you know, it was kind of a random journey down that path. But it was just interesting to see how a lot of the most powerful musical experiences I had that really have informed the success of the Jerusalem Youth Chorus came specifically in contrast to my formal musical education.
Right, right. And I mean, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but despite the fact that it was not the kind of approach to music that was A, close to your heart and that you had envisioned, I mean, I have to imagine that you picked up useful skills.
Totally. You know, and also, I think from a philosophical perspective, there's a way of having a more egalitarian approach to the wisdom that can be gleaned from multiple traditions. I'm not saying that there's nothing to be gained in like Western musical notation. Obviously, I use it all the time. And there's also a lot to be learned from improvisation and the oral tradition. And there's a lot to be learned from, you know, different approaches to even, you know, like quarter tones and different types of scales, and the exploration of those can lead to just totally different kinds of expression than are available when you're basically studying, you know, symphonies and arias only.
Right, exactly. And, you know, not to take us too off course, but I've had many discussions about how if you look at just the music that is the body of literature of Western classical music, which is, you know, both immensely long, it's 1,000 years of music, and also how it was at the time it was originally created, you can easily realize that the encrustation of, you know, tradition, which means just habitual practice, a kind of a rigid academicization, tends to actually take you away from what's beautiful and valuable in that music.
In that tradition, you know, even on its own terms. Exactly.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, I used to be in the business of making records of this kind of music. And it didn't take me long to realize that, you know, the collective institutional body that represents this art form is the worst enemy of this art form, unintentionally, right. But nevertheless.
Totally. Totally. Yeah. So anyway, we can move on from this point, but it is a soapbox. that I care a lot about, and I think is relevant if we're talking about what does it look like to bring together musical groups from around the world, as I know we're hoping to be able to do, right? How do you create that container for all of them to meet on their own terms? Like, that's a question that I've been asking for a long time, And I think, I think we can both agree that just like having everyone play classical music is probably not the way to do it.
No, exactly. I mean, I don't think that Brahms or Bach would have felt that way because they were surrounded by many other kinds of music, mostly folk traditions from within their realm. But they were also at the crossroads of a very migratory Europe, which is also still feeling influence from the Middle East, from the Arab world. So, we digress.
Indeed.
But now one name has come up in our previous conversation. That is one of the members of Sweet Honey and the Rock, who became an influence. Can you tell me about that?
Sure. So this was when I was 17, and I was in my last year of high school, and one of the key moments of my musical journey was particularly in holding this, you know, dichotomy of, you know, singing in choirs is this versus improvising and singing, you know, harmony by ear is this. And then I went to a community sing that Dr. Isai Barnwell was leading. And a community sing is basically an event that, you know, she kind of created this format where anybody can just walk in off the street, no requirement, no audition, no sheet music, no lyrics, no nothing, and just come in. And she, over the course of 2 hours, would teach music in multi-part harmony just by ear. And it was an extraordinary experience. And the energy was so cool. I think I left that sing and I thought, this is the most fun you can have without preparation.
That's great.
Right. Like on the spot, you just show up and then there's just this like magic that happens. And so I went up to her after that first sing and I said, I want to be your apprentice. She was like, do I need an apprentice? Like, I don't know. You know, yeah. but I really wanted to be it.
But I need you to be
But I need you to need me to be your apprentice. Exactly.
Right.
So.
Right.
Basically, I was then extremely persistent and was able ultimately to, for my senior project in high school, to apprentice to Isai Barnwell. And what I learned from her was profound in many regards. First, I learned how to lead community sings and how to create that sort of permission structure, but also support for people who literally think they can't sing to start singing in multi-part harmony in a group on the spot, right? So like that's kind of its own sort of bit of a superpower that that she has, and I learned from her techniques. And I also learned from her arranging and compositional style, and I also learned basically what is the Black music tradition, particularly Black music tradition of struggle, that she is a profound culture bearer of, both through her work with Sweet Honey and the Rock and just her solo work as well. This is a tradition that she knows intimately and is really a master teacher of. And so I learned from her so many elements of the Afrocentric musical worldview and what is the role of music in different types of social change movements. How do you ultimately leverage music as a powerful tool in the world, in particularly in situations of deep injustice? And so I came out of high school with that kind of toolkit and understanding, which has informed everything I do.
That's amazing. Now, just to look at the community thing where people just show up. Now, you know, they say that the single most common phobia is the phobia of speaking in public. Mm-hmm. But I have to believe that the fear of singing in public
is perhaps more, yeah.
more common and more intense. So, because it's, you know, I always think that actors, especially stage actors, where they are physically present with a live audience, that they have to essentially shed every possible inhibition, whether they are exposing themselves emotionally, revealing deep emotional secrets, even if they're not their own but their characters, to potentially expose themselves physically, depending on the part, that this requires an enormous amount of inner emotional training. Now, maybe to be in a community sing isn't quite that way because you're surrounded by others and you're doing it together, but how do you deal with that issue that people just, you know, maybe someone, you know, early on in their life said, don't do that. You can't sing. You
know? And, right.
And that, and these little chance remarks in a young child can produce a really profound and lasting impact that stays with them throughout their lives. So how do you get around that? How did she get around that?
So part of it is about giving people just the permission explicitly to sing, particular and addressing head on the idea that maybe they think they can't, and just saying like, do it. It's going to be okay. This is safe. No one's going to like look at you and go, shh. So that's one. Two is then creating the support for people to actually succeed in the task that I am giving them, in the challenge of singing together in a group. And part of that also is in the way that the group can support each other, right? That's really important. But then the third is also sort of the approach to it. And part of it, I'd call it a sort of gentle and humorous assertiveness. So it's like, you can't give people the opportunity to second guess themselves out of it. So you're just like, okay, we're going to do this now. Here's your part. If you sound bad, sing louder, you know? And, you know, and so people understand that they don't need to take themselves too seriously, but also that staying silent is not one of the options that I've given them, right? That like, if you're here, you're participating, and we're not going to like be precious about it.
So, okay, so you now have taken on this mantle that, you know, Dr. Barnwell handed to you. How does this now translate all the way across the ocean to take you to the Middle East? What was your first exposure to, you know, to life in Israel?
So I actually, a month or two after my apprenticeship to Dr. Barnwell in high school, I went over to Jerusalem basically for the summer doing some language study, but mostly to just really have experiences with Israeli and Palestinian friends that I had made in the course of my then sort of two summers and other time of dialogue work. I really just wanted to go and be on the ground and have experiences and see people in their homes and learn. And one of the most powerful moments actually of my life happened that summer. It was one day, it was deeply pivotal. And it was when I met the Asleh family. And the Asleh family were a Palestinian family in the north of Israel. And their son, Asil, had been a camper at Seeds of Peace, which was the summer camp I went to where I first experienced the power of dialogue. And he was a really a rising star peace builder, created like all this community with all of his friends of different backgrounds, and then was shot and killed at point blank range by an Israeli soldier. And that the spirit that he brought, I never met him. He was at camp years before I had even heard of Seeds of Peace. But he became a legend and an inspiration in that community. And his favorite quote was a poem, the beginning of a poem by Rumi, out beyond ideas of wrongdoing and right doing, there's a field, I'll meet you there. And to me, that quote really encapsulated so much of what I had learned in my first summer at Seeds, and that sort of dialogue process, getting past the place where it's this zero-sum game, and it's this dynamic where if I'm right, you must be wrong, and if you're right, I must be wrong, and getting to a place of being together in all of it, to me was very, very important and powerful, and that was his favorite quote. So when I had the opportunity to create a choral piece, I thought about what text might be meaningful, and I chose that poem. And so I had written a choral piece that I called A Seal's Field in his memory. And I was very, very proud of it. And we sang it at Seeds, and we sang it in my high school, and we sang it all over, and people were moved to tears. And it was this really powerful piece of music. And so when I was in Jerusalem on the ground, somebody suggested that I should go meet his family and give them this music that I had written for their son in his memory. And I said, okay. And so I found a way to connect with them. And I went up four buses into their very, very small village in the north of Arabe, and was picked up by Asil's sister. And she was driving me to their home. And that day I had three different experiences that just totally blew my mind and powerfully impacted the way I think about all of this work. First, Asil's sister was telling me about all the different ways that since Asil's death, her family and her parents in particular had been trying to get justice for his murder. And there was a whole commission in the Israeli government trying to investigate and figure it out, but ultimately it kept, you know, being messed with, and it seemed that the government was always one step ahead of justice, and all kinds of games and tampering with this and gaslighting over here and changing the rules and all of these things that seemingly made things feel so futile. And she was sharing how her parents were so single-mindedly dedicated to getting justice legally through this investigation and demonstrations and other ways of bringing some semblance of justice to the situation. But Nardine was saying, look, like, I love my brother, and I also need to, like, live my life, right? Like, I need to... She was a doctor. She was just starting a family. She was like, look, I need to also live. That is my way of bringing some sort of goodness to the situation. And she was talking about how it was tearing her family apart. And it was so challenging and felt so impossible for them. And ultimately, she said, look, like, I would never do this. I know that it wouldn't accomplish anything, but sometimes I'm so desperate, it makes me think about what would it be to, like, blow myself up in a cafe. And I got it. I, like, understood fundamentally what would drive somebody to do that. And she's, like, worked in an Israeli hospital, like, spoke fluent Hebrew, like, very integrated, very peaceful person. But just that desperation, understanding what are the systems that we're up against, was very profound for me. The second thing was then finally late that evening being able to actually play this music for their family. And I had come all this way to give them this music, and I told them what it was about, and I read the lyrics, and then I played the music for them, and I was really hopeful that it would somehow be a gift or of a contribution or move them in some way. Like, no response emotionally. Like, I could tell that the music had just completely missed the mark for them. That there was just no connection there, that there was nothing that I had written in the music itself that spoke to them. And that took me months to process, right? And shattered everything that I had assumed and thought about music and what it was for and how, what it could accomplish and who it would speak to and what I, what agency I had and all these things. You know, of course, months later, till I realized, wait a minute, like, I have never studied Arabic music. So, like, why did I think that what I was going to write was going to speak to them, right? But it was this profound shift where, like, going back to what we were talking about earlier about people who are sort of perpetuating this system of classical music, Western classical music, who assume it's the idea of music as a universal language comes from that tradition as well. And it's in the context of people who basically were saying Beethoven is the best and highest Platonic form of music. And anyone who doesn't get it is because they just don't get it, you know, because they're uneducated or whatever. But like, it's universal somehow, right? And seeing that actually I hadn't done my homework. It was deeply impactful for me and led me to then go study classical Arabic music in Damascus and in many other contexts to actually be able to create music that could really have a foothold in multiple cultures. And the third then was, after all of that, ending up very late at night, there was no way I was going to make it back to Jerusalem. And so with both of these, like, mind-blowing, deeply destabilizing experiences for my 17-year-old self, then they were like, okay, well, you're obviously staying the night. You can sleep in a seal's bed. Right? And so there I was in his room with his martyr plaques on the walls, trying to make sense of everything that I had just experienced and thinking, like, okay, what is my role in this, right? And what am I, what is my responsibility now to try to fix this somehow with the tools that I have? And that moment, if there was any moment that really led me to want to build the Jerusalem Youth Chorus, it was that day.
Right, right. You know, it must have been a profoundly humbling experience to be forced into this massive reset. The whole concept of music as a universal language, well, I don't discount it, but I think that it is incredibly presumptuous to say music is a universal language and it is up to you and your responsibility to understand my dialect.
Correct. Correct. You know, there's so much about music, obviously, that translates better than spoken language. Of course, it's more permeable than, like, well, sorry, I don't speak Chinese. I just have no idea what you're saying. You know, there's obviously much more fluidity and much more permeability there, but it's not true to just say, like, well, if I write a piece of music that's good enough, everyone will just get it. You know, like, at the depth that I mean it. Right? That's just not how it works, because people have their own musical languages, and that's part of what makes it so beautiful.
It actually reminds me of something that Stravinsky once said, you know, at the time when his music was still considered very strange and very modern and hard to listen to. And he said, you know, some people say that my music isn't music because they don't understand it. Well, I don't understand Chinese, but I don't deny that it's a language.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
So now you have been humbled, and you clearly have a major reset in your thinking and a lot of processing to do. How long did it take you to begin to assimilate these incredibly powerful inputs?
So it was really then over the course of the time I was in college, which ultimately was 5 years. I took a year off to sing with the Whiffenpoofs my senior year. And so that was a whole other sort of global musical experience. And I actually wrote articles in the Yale student, like, foreign affairs magazine, basically about some of the musical interactions we had on that tour and what are their, like, political and social and cultural implications. So anyway, it was, like, very interesting. But ultimately, I was studying the different components of what became the Jerusalem Youth Chorus and how to weave them together. And a month after I graduated from college, I moved to Jerusalem to found the chorus.
Wow. So, okay. Micah, now what, age 21, maybe 22?
Yeah, I was 22. Yeah.
Arrives in Jerusalem. And what do? Put up handbills saying, you know, join my choir? I mean, what was your starting point?
So one of the things that was really important was that I had done my senior thesis work essentially on to what extent is it possible to replicate the kinds of music and dialogue dynamics that I'd experienced at Seeds of Peace on the ground in Jerusalem in a sustained way. So I had already experienced a lot of the mistakes in advance. And so one of the things I learned from that research was why people join work like this in the first place. And the idea that their reasons may be completely different from the reasons that I think the work is important and completely different than the reasons why a donor may want to fund it, right? That the reasons that a participant might find this to be good are probably not because they want to be peace builders, right? So I knew to be able to come to Jerusalem and speak to people on their own terms in ways that wouldn't make me sound like a naive idiot. And so I was able to go into schools in East and West Jerusalem and basically say, hey, this is going to be the coolest thing you do in high school. You are going to learn to sing. You're going to make new friends. You're going to be able to write your own songs and sing on the radio and tour internationally and learn new languages. And maybe you like feel certain ways about your city and the way that living in Jerusalem has impacted your life and identity. And you'll have a chance to talk to people from other parts of Jerusalem and learn from them and share with them like why what matters to you matters to you. And people were like, oh, that sounds kind of cool. And auditioned. And so that was really important. I had conditioned myself. I moved in July 2012. I moved in July 2012 and had conditioned myself that if by January I had 10 singers, I was doing okay. And instead, by September, I had 80 singers audition, of which we were able to accept 30. And we started the chorus, right? And even from that early moment, of course, there were all kinds of mistakes that I made, but fundamentally, I got the model right because I had done my homework. And we had a sort of music dialogue sandwich of sorts, is how we think about it, where we start with music, we start with an hour of just singing together, and then have a short break and then an hour and a half of facilitated dialogue. And then after a longer break, another hour of music. And of course the music holds this space, right? And holds people together and creates this glue and this trust and this feeling just good together. And like, we have to rely on each other and listen to each other, and then it sounds awesome and it feels good. And within that, you can then push out a little bit with some of these really, really hard topics that are really divisive, and people come from completely opposite perspectives on and completely opposite life experiences of, with totally different realities, right? So it's a space that can contain all of that within the music. So in many ways, it's a sort of equilibrium where the music is sort of holding in and the dialogue is pushing out. And it's really important because if we only did the music, we wouldn't be able to meet through wars. We wouldn't be able to meet when things get insane because people would just have no vocabulary to process or talk about it or hold it in the group. Similarly, if we were only doing dialogue in those times, people would just stop showing up because dialogue is hard and generally doesn't feel good. It's important. It's like eating your vegetables, right? Music is the fun part, feels really good, but it has to be grounded in reality. And that's what really sets the Jerusalem Youth Chorus apart from so many other programs that are working to bring Israelis and Palestinians together, that only do like one of those, or that only do their activity, whether it's music or something else, or that only sit and talk, right? But in combining those two, and specifically using singing and communal singing as our way of doing that, which is just so evolutionarily hardwired as a tool for building trust in human beings and has been for thousands of years, that it works. And then we've been able to not only continue to meet through wars and periods of violence, but even this past year, which has been just beyond excruciating on a daily basis for so many people. And all of our singers know someone who has been killed, kidnapped, or displaced in the last year. It's a small place, and everybody knows somebody. And it's really personal. Like, singers would tell stories about how their friends are like held hostage in Gaza, or how one of their friends was shot by a soldier in front of their eyes in their neighborhood, right? And that's real. And that's what our singers are bringing into this space, but they feel that this is a space that values them, that holds them, and where their stories can have a platform, right? Where they can be fully themselves, not only to each other, but on stage. And that's really, really valuable. And that's why people come back.
It's really amazing. The concept that you start off by doing something together. Essentially, you become a team because basically a group sing, you're all members of a team. And whereas in other facets of the singer's lives, they may consider that impossible. There's this divide, in some cases a physical wall that separates them, that basically can't exist or else no sound comes out. And once the stage is set from that interdependency, collaboration, cooperation, it must be an enormous defense lowerer, or let's say trauma assuager. Not that you can really make the trauma go away through the singing, but that you basically have been confronted at a deep emotional level with something that runs counter to what, you know, the prefrontal cortex tells you about those people.
Yeah.
And what the amygdala tells you about fearing those people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, all these different parts of the brain that basically tell you this doesn't work. Suddenly, they basically just get, so to speak, put to sleep for, mm-hmm. you know, 20 minutes or a half hour, 40 minutes. And that must then create an atmosphere in which, without masking the pain, they actually are able to communicate when it comes time to speak. Rather than ripping the scab off it and exposing the wound, it must be kind of like, we can talk about the wound, but there's a bit of anesthetic applied to it that makes it possible for us to really examine it.
Exactly. And there's a way that the music softens the group and makes the edges a little bit less sharp, which doesn't make the pain any less real, right? But it allows us, I think, as you said, to talk about it in a way that maybe you can hear it and hold it instead of feeling attacked by the fact that, like, I had this experience and I'm sharing it with you, right? And so that's what enables the singers to hold space for each other in this. Like, there was a moment where one of our Palestinian singers was not able to come to rehearsal for a few weeks because he was arrested because the Israeli police had accused him of throwing stones. And he was then interrogated and beaten and all kinds of horrible things. He's like 15-year-old kid, super sweet, but in a really challenging neighborhood of East Jerusalem, where there are a lot of settlers who are taking over Palestinian houses and then a lot of Palestinians throwing stones at the settlers, particularly young people his age. And so he was in this difficult position and basically just wanted to be in the chorus, right? So he came to rehearsal after he was released, and we were trying to think, okay, like, is this going to be too weird for the Israelis? Are they going to be able to hold space for him? Are they going to be afraid of him? Right? And he, we created the right conditions for him to be able to just tell his story to everybody. And people were mostly shocked by what had happened to him and just wanted to support him and were glad that he was there. And like, nobody left. Nobody was like, oh, you deserved this. Like, everyone was just like, oh my God, that's horrible. I'm so sorry. Right? And that, like, that could have been like security threat for like any random group of Israelis, right? But to be able to instead hold that and say, okay, but like you're our friend and like we know that you don't hate us.
Let me ask another maybe challenging question. So these young people, they don't live in a vacuum. They have families that they go home to after they spend time with you and with the chorus. They have communities, they have schoolmates who are, I'm going to guess, for the most part, from their own community, their own religious or ethnic background. Do they receive negative pressure? Like, you know, you're betraying us by spending time. You know, are they subject to peer pressure, family pressure that creates any kind of an inner conflict for them to... for the work that they're doing together and the music that they're making together?
Totally. All the time. And that's really important. And one of the things that we're always working to support them through, right? So many singers on both sides have had friends, family members, teachers, religious leaders, neighbors, you know, basically tell them that what they're doing is wrong at best. And threatening them at worst, right? And so we support them through that. We try to engage when we can with the folks, particularly if they're family members, if they're willing to talk to us. Sometimes they are, sometimes they aren't, you know. But what's been really powerful in certain cases where there have been family members who are really suspicious or really opposed, we say, look, just like come to a concert or even come to a rehearsal. Just like see for yourself. We're not hiding anything. We're not like trying to brainwash your child. We're not like secret missionaries of some religion. We're really just trying to create this space. And like you can come and see. And then they come and they see their kid shining and so happy and so themselves. That sometimes works. I say sometimes because like we're not trying to pretend that sometimes we can fix everything. Or that, like, there aren't people who then pull their kid, right? Like, this happens, but we dialogue it out and we use the tools that we have, and we're not going to be able to change everybody, you know, but we can do what we can do. And what we can do is a lot more than I think most people ever expected and more than I ever dreamed.
But you can't win them all.
Totally. Totally.
Tragically.
Yes.
Tragically. Because it almost must make the your singers, I want to say kids, but I know that they're not like children. They're what, mostly in their teens?
Teenagers, yeah.
Late adolescents. Mm-hmm. But it's also in a way one of the most vulnerable periods in a young person's growth because their bodies are changing and they feel self-conscious about everything and the need to belong to an accepting peer group is especially intense and acute. And so the only way I could describe it is for those who are able to resist that pressure, or let's say stay steadfast to the experience of the chorus, it must take an incredible amount of courage. It must take a great deal of inner strength.
Totally. And singers often tell us like how hard it is for them if they're being bullied at school for being in the chorus, or if their parent is trying to give them like babysitting and other duties that they have to do at rehearsal time specifically so they won't be able to come. And like there's all kinds of stuff that people have tried to put in their way beyond even just swimming in the water that everyone is swimming in, right? It takes so much courage, and it takes so much courage not just to be there, but then to perform. And to perform on big stages, locally and globally. Like 5 million people saw our America's Got Talent performance.
Yeah, I want to get to that, but it is such an exercise in, you know, to use old psychobabble, you know, self-actualization, and also in this sense, group actualization, creating a community and making that a very resilient and courageous and strong community. But another part of it, because certainly from my experience of listening to the chorus, is the cathartic level of expression that comes through the particular music that you choose to perform, which really gives voice to both the pain, the challenge, and also perhaps the hope and idealism, which sometimes seems very, very hard to maintain, that, you know, there could be a better way, a better time. How do you develop the repertoire? What is the process? Because, first of all, the music is incredibly beautiful.
Thank you.
It does seem to have a kind of interesting cross-cultural ability to live in the two worlds and the two traditions, which I find very interesting. And certainly from, you know, the, you know, sort of folk songs and, you know, folk inflected, you know, sort of pop singer songwriter songs when I went to Hebrew school, you know, that there was, you know, clearly a tradition that grew up since Israel was founded to write in that idiom, more than in a more formal, let's say, you know, traditional American pop style, that it really is an intentionally folk-feeling style, but it also feels like it draws upon some of the harmonic structures, the melodic forms and you know, modes in Arabic music.
Totally. And it's one of the things that I love most about the work that I get to do is actually approaching our repertoire. It's one of my favorite parts of all the work. Because it allows us to be creative in exactly that kind of a way, to ask those questions, right, that I learned at the Asles to ask, right, is like, how is this song going to reach people from these different backgrounds, and why, and how can we find the resonance between different traditions? So we have a video, that we're about to release, or by the time this podcast airs, we probably will have just released, that's a mashup of three songs in three languages, and we're calling it a mashup of possibilities. And it's a mashup of three iconic pop songs, one in Hebrew, one in Arabic, one in English, that are all in this theme of seizing agency. And so the impetus for this was that we asked the singers, like, what songs they wanted to sing last year. And this was at the beginning of the year, and there were a lot of really bad suggestions, just a lot of really cliche suggestions. And the least worst option in my mind, which ultimately became an amazing option, but in my initial thinking about it, I was like, ugh, this is so cliche, was to sing How Far I'll Go from Moana. And because, like, that got, like, the most votes, right? Because people, it was just like a pop song and people loved it. And I was like, okay, if we're gonna sing How Far I'll Go, and I was like, you know, it, like, vibes, like, it's about, like, you know, seizing the day, and, like, that's good. I was like, if we're gonna sing How Far I'll Go, we're gonna do it in a JYC way. And so we then found Arabic and Hebrew pop songs on the same theme, and then figured out how to mash them all up so that they made sense. And that is the video that then we're releasing, that we're so excited about and our singers have loved and, like, performed all over, and are just so stoked about. And each of them have a space where they can be in it, and the the Israelis, like, all know that Israeli song that we're singing and are really excited to solo on it. And the Palestinians all knew that, like, Arabic song that we're doing in it, and they can sing it with their, like, Arab and the right inflection and really solo on it in the right way. And everybody was stoked about Moana. And then we filmed it, like, in an overnight video shoot, ending up at the beach at sunrise, right? So it's just this kind of, like, moment of just like a little dip into the JYC creative process. But it was so cool. It was so cool.
And it arose organically. And I'm happy to say that you didn't say that the most asked for song was Over the Rainbow, because that would be just
too much.
Too much.
Too much.
Well, I can hardly wait to hear it. And clearly, actually, a big part of this is understanding the inflections of the two languages, because of course they shape the rhythms. There's a music to words,
yep,
just as there are words to go with music. And so even beginning to absorb those sonorities must be the beginnings of a bit of a bridge.
Totally. And everyone learns to sing in the other languages, right? That's really important. That even some of the sort of descant lines, for example, in the Arabic piece of the mashup are sung by one of our Israeli singers. And actually one of our Israeli singers who lives in a settlement in the West Bank, right? So there's like all kinds of layers to all of this. It's just really, really much more layered and complex and hard to disentangle unless you're really looking at everything and give some, you know, gentleness to like let things maybe untangle a little on their own. If you're just kind of looking at it and being like, that's the problem, it's like, that isn't working and it's not gonna work, that kind of approach.
Right. And by the way, you know, even though the part of your core value set is everyone can sing, these kids are really good.
Yeah.
They're really, really good.
There are different contexts for that. Totally. Like, if you're going to be in a performing ensemble, then I think it makes sense to, you know, have some structures to make sure that you can perform well, right? The thing about, of course, Community Sings is it's not a performance, right? And so then, like, everyone should be able to do it. But, like, so many people don't see that there are spaces that aren't a performance where they can sing, right? So then it becomes, well, if I don't want to be on stage, I'm just going to be in the audience. And that dichotomy is a huge problem.
Well, that brings me to another question. So when was your first ever public performance, and how nervous were you? You must have had real questions about how it was going to be received, whether an audience, presumably that invited, you know, families from both communities, as well as members of the general public from both communities, how that was going to go over, whether you were going to get picketed or worse, you know. So what sort of trepidations did you have, or am I just projecting? Because I feel nervous thinking about it. Yeah. What was the actual experience like?
Our first concert was it was December 2012, so it was that sort of 6 months after I arrived and 3 months after we started rehearsing. And it was awesome. You know, the group, you know, was definitely new. Like, we sounded new, like it wasn't super polished, but it was good enough for people to see that we could sing and that we were doing something beautiful together that was just at the beginning. And the most important thing, and this is, I think, the most important thing in all of our performances that has always been true, and may it always be true, is that you can see that the singers are actually friends. That's the most important part of what we're actually demonstrating here, right? Is not that, like, everything is, like, perfectly tuned. You know, it has to be tuned well in order to work, right? If people are hearing a cacophony, they're not going to be inspired and moved, right? But at a certain point, it's more important that people see that this is authentic than that people see that it's perfect. And that authenticity is not just musical authenticity, but is ultimately just in the energy that the singers bring and the fact that you can tell that they care about each other deeply and they support each other. Because that's ultimately the kind of future and society and world that we're trying to inspire and catalyze through the music, is not one that is perfect, but one that is able to hold all of it.
Right. So the audience accepted it. There were no fist fights in the,
no.
you know, in the audience.
No.
They didn't all, you know, one committee sat on one side of the house
nope.
and the other on the other side.
Nope.
None of that.
People were moved. I mean, and I'm sure in the beginning that some of the parents probably may have been a little trepidatious and whatever, but ultimately they saw that, like, the other parents were having the same experience that they were having at this concert and just being so stoked for their kids and so moved by this. Like, just people, a lot of people, even who come skeptical, most of the time leave very moved.
So very quickly began to develop experience performing in public,
yeah,
which obviously must also have provided a tremendous feeling of validation and reinforcement for the singers in the chorus. When did you first begin performing outside of Israel?
So our first tour actually was during the Gaza War in 2014, to Japan, of all places.
Oh, wow.
Because there was a community in Japan that I had sung with the Whiffenpoofs, who were extremely excited about what I was doing in Jerusalem, and I had maintained a relationship with them, and they said, we want to bring you to Japan. I was like, okay, let's go. You know, but that was during the Gaza War 10 years ago. And that was a real challenge in that moment, to be able to travel and to be able to present on stage together. But we made it. And the singers had a life-changing experience. And we were on the front page of, like, all these newspapers and all these TV shows. We did a huge performance in the Kyoto Concert Hall with, like, 10 other ensembles and a youth orchestra. And it was really, really powerful. And from that tour, there was a song that we sang, apropos of reaching people on their own terms, in Japanese, that we were recommended by our hosts, and the song was called Hana Wasaku, and it means flowers will bloom. And it was a song about resilience that was sort of a Japanese version of We Are the World after the tsunami in 2012, I believe.
Right.
And so it was this really huge song that, like, all these Japanese singers and actors and celebrities had all done a sort of We Are the World style video in wake of the tsunami to, like, bring resilience. And so we sang this song, and it was so powerful. I remember being in that concert, and we started singing it, and everyone just started, like, the audience just started crying and singing along. That was, like, those were the responses. And then someone came and just gave us all flowers. And we're just standing at the front of the stage, and there are, like, five other Japanese youth and other choirs all throughout the hall, and 100-person Japanese youth orchestra behind us. And we have these flowers and are singing about how flowers will bloom again, right? Which was basically the refrain of the song. And everyone in the audience is standing and singing. It was unreal. It was unreal. Like, that's that kind of connective power of music, when you really reach people and want to listen before singing, you know, in terms of, like, what was the right song for that moment. We learned it properly in Japanese, and then we were able to give this real gift of connection.
And, you know, I mean, I'm going to say something that's going to sound hopelessly naive and incredibly Pollyanna-ish, but there has to also have been this feeling that, you know, hey, if we learn to love each other, the rest of the world is going to love us back when they see it. Because the reinforcement that comes from an international audience, where their exposure with Israel is probably what they see on video on the news, which is mostly conflict and violence, you know, extreme political statements, you know, expressions of hatred and hostility, and frankly, grandstanding politicians just trying to self-aggrandize by, you know, by saying irresponsible things. And then they see an image of what this part of the world can be that is so totally at odds with it, and it is so much less horrible and distasteful, frankly, that people can't help but respond with an enormous amount of relief and affection. And that has to be also part of the message that gets carried back.
That's totally been our experience. And even in the performance that we did on America's Got Talent this past year, we were really scared, honestly, that we were going to be slammed on the internet and that people were going to just hate us and we were going to get so much hate. And we prepared and got digital security and really invested in preparing for this onslaught of hate that we were expecting. And it just didn't come. It didn't come. People were just so moved. You know, there were occasionally comments where people would say, like, I don't believe it. That can't be real. This is like framed for TV. But most people were like, wow, thank you. Like, I'm crying. This is so important. Why can't our leaders do this? Like, everyone needs to see this. Like, da 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 da. You know, because not just the authenticity of the relationships and the music, but also because we got the messaging right. And that was something that we spent dozens of hours working on, was like, okay, we're going to have like 30 seconds. What is our message in this moment? And how do we make sure that we're both saying something that is worth saying and also are saying it in a way that can be heard by people who are of vastly different political opinions on perhaps the most polarizing topic around?
Who from a TV network and a network TV show was courageous enough to say, you know what, even though, you know, someone might actually send us, you know, an extremely unpleasant package that does something extremely unpleasant because they're part of one of the extreme parts of the polarity that this part of the world evokes, you know, goddammit, we're going to do this, you know? I mean, did you get a sense of the internal workings that they thought that the time was right for this, that they felt that it needed to be heard, or they just liked the music?
I mean, there was a lot of tension I can just share in terms of folks feeling both deeply inspired and fearful, right? And ultimately, we were working with them and sort of massaged it through so that we were able to come across in the way that felt authentic and honest. And it wasn't without peril, and it wasn't without a lot of challenge and hardship, right? That I can't, you know, necessarily go into everything, but it was a challenging experience as well as being a really powerful one. You know, because for all the reasons that you said.
And of course, you want in this very, very tight time frame to be able to get the music, your message, your values, keep it from being kitschy,
right,
and, you know, tawdry and tacky, which it can be, you know, and particularly because you can't control what the judges are going to say, and they might say, frankly, stupid things.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you can't predict the audience's response, although you kind of can, because I'm pretty sure they have a pretty big applause sign that goes on behind you. But nevertheless, they loved you.
Yeah, I mean, what was amazing, particularly, we got a standing ovation before we even started singing. Just like when in the editing, they sort of switched things around. But the order is you come on stage and the judges ask you who you are and you tell them, and we got a standing ovation, right? And then we started singing, and then in the middle of the song got another standing ovation, right? So it was just really, really powerful for folks that this was a thing that even existed, let alone that they could like be part of it and amplify it. And the judges loved us.
And folks, if you haven't seen this, it's on YouTube, go watch it. And after that, the other thing that you really need to watch about the Jerusalem Youth Chorus is this extraordinary TED Talk that you did. I think it was in Vancouver, mm-hmm, just a few months ago, right? I mean, you really told the story. It's a big story, so obviously I know you have to you can't go into all the detail, but you know, in that whatever it is, 19 or 20 minutes, you really managed to sort of knock it out of the park.
Thank you. Yeah, with the TED Talk in particular, it was both a chance to share a really powerful song that our singers wrote after October 7th, so in the last year, with their stories and their feelings and their words and what they wanted to express, and also an opportunity for Amer, our executive director, who's one of our Palestinian graduates and is absolutely incredible leader and friend and someone from whom I'm learning every day, and met when he was 16 and he auditioned for the chorus and had never sung before, right? And now he's our executive director. And Amer and I had a chance on the TED stage to really say some powerful things that we felt needed to be said and needed to be heard about not just who we are, but about why we're doing this work and why it's vital to have these kinds of connections, and not just because it like feels good, but because fundamentally the politicians are failing us and the cycle of violence is perpetuated by the extremists on both sides who benefit from one another's extremism. And if there's no alternative, if people feel like that's their only option, then they're like, well, I guess that sucks, but we'll do it. As opposed to, wait a minute, what if we just chose a different way? And so the song that we sing in that TED Talk is called A Different Way. And so it was a really powerful opportunity, I think, to go a level deeper in terms of the why of the work.
Absolutely. And what you say is so correct. We have what economists, I think, call perverse incentives. Mm. You know, it reminds me of an episode, you're probably too young to remember the original Star Trek, but there was an episode in which there was this creature that invades the Enterprise who lives on hatred.
Oh, wow.
Literally, it draws its life energy from hatred and provokes fights and hatred and ultimately nearly a civil war among the crew of the Enterprise by essentially, you know, infesting their brains and forcing them to generate hatred and conflict. And from that, it
feeds
and grows stronger. And it's a great metaphor for, you know, the world we're living in. Of course, Gene Roddenberry imagined that we would by now have grown up enough as a species to get beyond that. But it does raise a really interesting question about the exportability of your model, the ability for initiatives that have their roots in your learning, your experience, your teaching method, your repertoire evolution, your finding the platform to give voice to people who are divided and sometimes by enormous gulfs. And so are you besieged by people from other parts of the world saying, we want to come and learn so that we can do this in our part of the world?
So we're actually right now in a position where we're starting to think about that kind of scale and think about how we can partner with organizations around the world that are doing either all of this work or part of this work that we can help to strengthen and we can partner with and we can equip and we can help to give a platform and ultimately build strength in numbers and really build a movement, a network, a community of organizations and musicians and communities that are able to wield the power of music in this kind of way that it just is so needed in so many places. And I think fundamentally now, as we're seeing even with technology and the sort of isolation that so many people feel now from their neighbors everywhere, in so many different ways, that music is this connective technology that was created in early sort of human history to build community. That's like why we make music, is to communicate with others and to feel what the other person feels. It's like an empathy tool and a community building, an identity sharing tool. and we still have it, and it still works if we decide to use it. So we're down, and we are really excited to share our learnings and to help be hopefully a source of not only experience, not only a toolkit, but also a bit of a catalytic force and a dollop of hope.
Well, you know, it seems to me that what someone needs to do is put together a global gathering of groups, like-minded groups from around the world, so that they can learn these messages. You know, why doesn't someone do that?
What a perfect, what a
someone
great,
really ought
Brian,
to do
what
that.
A great idea.
More later. Prepare for an announcement in the future, but let's suffice it to say that we're cooking something up. This guy and some other great guys and gals and human beings to basically find a way to unlock the power of music to make good things happen in the world. But I want to end by telling you my fantasy, Micah. So we smuggle you into the United Nations, lock the doors, and no one gets out until they sing in perfect harmony together.
I'm down.
And you force all the people who are currently lobbing bombs at each other to basically sing the solos in their underwear.
This I love, and sign me up. Sign me up. I accept this challenge.
All right. Alas, if what the average politician said with a straight face they had to sing, perhaps in mock operatic style, they'd realize what a pack of buffoons they can really be at times.
That's funny.
And how out of touch with reality. Just imagine, you know, if you remember those Bugs Bunny cartoons, The Rabbit of Seville?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. There we
just,
are.
You know, basically, do a State of the Union in Elmer Fudd style,
oh,
and let's
God.
See how seriously people
out.
Take you. Anyway, well, Micah, I just want to thank you. We've had some technical issues along the way, but we think that the recording is fine.
Good.
So so thank you for being patient through that, and really the work you're doing is inspiring. I can't tell our listeners how important this is. So what I'm going to tell you is, and partly this is entirely selfish on our part as well, just get people to come and listen to this program, because the more people who know about this, the more people who will be wanting to carry this message into their communities, right to their relatives in different parts of the world. You know, take the message into parts of the world where there are refugees, where there is war, where there is hunger, where there is civil divide, racial intolerance, religious intolerance, class intolerance, and just can't, you know, this is like the, again, I'm drifting off into Pollyanna cliches, but, you know, the old can't we just get along? Well, yeah, actually we can, you know, and one way of doing it is to unlock something that reaches more deeply into the psyche than our conscious awareness of what's supposed to divide us by finding those harmonic resonances that actually can make us feel like we're part of a bigger whole. So, Micah, thank you. Bless you for the work you do. It's really an inspiration. And we will see you in the not-too-distant future, I am sure.
Brian, thank you so much for having me and for all the work that you're doing.
The Glenn Gould Foundation is a registered Canadian charity, and we rely on the support of arts lovers like you to keep bringing inspiring stories to life. Please consider giving by visiting our website, glenngould.ca, and follow us across social media at the Glenn Gould Foundation. Thank you so much for joining us for this episode of The Gould Standard.